I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 164 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. I first saw and heard this week's guest at the Chicago Club Double Door in 1999. I was there to see Richard Thompson, whose typically killer band then included bassist Danny Thompson, multi-instrumentalist Pete Zorn, Richard's son Teddy, and a drummer I'd never seen before. Linda Thompson, Richard's former singing partner and ex-wife, was in the audience. The band opened with the first five songs from Richard Thompson's not-yet-released new album, Mock Tutor, and I was knocked out. I'd seen Thompson play with great drummers before, such as Dave Maddox and Kenny Aronoff, but something special was happening here. The new young guy was pushing Thompson and the others, adding all sorts of textures, providing counterparts to Thompson's dazzling solos, and taking everything to new heights. He was a keeper, and Thompson, who went on to become my first Caro Pop guest, agreed. Michael Jerome has been his drummer on albums and tours ever since. I saw them in October playing behind Thompson's latest album, Ship to Shore, and they sounded as strong as ever. Michael Jerome has done much more than anchor Thompson's band over the past 25 years. He recorded and toured with John Cale for several years. He's been better than Ezra's drummer since 2009, including an album and tour last year. He also recorded and toured with Slash for his 2024 blues album, Orgy of the Damned. Jerome has drummed with blues harmonica player Charlie Musselwhite, the Blind Boys of Alabama, and many others as well. I noticed that Jerome was the drummer on solo projects from one of my favorite music people, Victor Krummenacher, the fantastic Camper Van Beethoven Monks of Doom bassist, and another previous Caro Pop guest. In 2020, Krummenacher and guitarist-singer-songwriter Dave Alvin assembled an experimental psychedelic band called The Third Mind, with Jerome behind the kit. On their first self-titled album that year, they went into the studio without rehearsing and played improvised versions of mostly cover songs. As Jerome details here, the pandemic scuttled their first tour, and Alvin began cancer treatments, so The Third Mind seemed like a one-off project. But the band regrouped last year to record and release the even more beautifully trippy The Third Mind 2 and to play its first ever live dates. Michael Jerome lives in Los Angeles, and we spoke days after catastrophic wildfires began to ravage the region and destroy thousands of homes and businesses. His place is okay, but with the fires still burning, the winds continuing to rage, the crisis weighs heavily on him. He relates what it's like to be in his community now as he tries to help out friends and others who have lost almost everything.
We're trying to remember the good times.
Then we hit the rewind button to discuss his younger days in Dallas, what a big influence his mother, a music teacher, was, and how he discovered his love of drums at the expense of a piano. He talks about his early bands Pop Poppins, Toadies, and Course of Empire, and how he had to shift gears when his manager suggested he try out for Richard Thompson's band. How he landed that gig is a great story. How does playing with Thompson contrast with his work with John Cale, or blues artists such as Musselwhite? How does he approach each of those collaborations? Does he feel the most freedom in The Third Mind? Has that gone from a side project to major band? I was not surprised to find that Jerome is as thoughtful in conversation as he is talented as a musician. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Michael Jerome.
It's good to be with you today.
Thank you. Well, it's great to have you. Yeah, and especially with all that's going on out there, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Yes, indeed. It's been an ordeal and a very tragic situation for a lot of people today, this week. And we're just in the midst of things like this when they come about. You just try to stay as positive as possible. And but there are so many people that have lost so much, everything that they've known, some of them their entire lives. And so it's really just being there for them. That's what this week's really been about, and just being alert because these things are popping up out of nowhere. It's been a tough one. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, it's like, I mean, whether it's, you know, musicians or producers or just, you know, anyone who's living out there. I mean, it's just, you know, you know a lot of people, I imagine, and, you know, you're probably hearing from a lot of them and hearing about a lot of them.
A lot of people are reaching out to first check on you to see what you're, you know, if you're okay and you're safe, and you're doing the same for your friends. And as And as the days go by, you don't even realize how many more people that you haven't even spoken to yet. And then you're like, oh, I need to, what about, you know?
Right.
And then sure enough, you know, they've either posted something, some, you know, or you've reached out and it's confirmed that they've lost their house or been displaced or had to evacuate and so on. You know, everybody's sharing the same story here this week.
Yeah, it's one of those times where you actually are reminded why how social media can be useful, because it actually is a way that people can get out information among their social groups to say, hey, I need help. Hey, I'm okay, but I'm available to help, you know, and, you know, connecting all that stuff.
That's exactly right. You know, it's comforting when you can, you know, queue up a friend on social and see that they've posted that they're safe, or you can see them sharing their story and they're, you know, usually pretty emotional, obviously, understandably. And, but at least you can see them, you know, the horrible thought is that you reach out and there's no response, or that you don't hear back from them, or you see something posted that, your friend was lost or someone was tragically, became, you know, fell victim to what's going on, you know, so that's what you don't want. And so, you know, I'd rather see a very emotional post of that I've lost everything, because to me, it's like, yeah, you have, except for your life. And
right.
I thank God that I'm watching this post. I'll just give you a call and let you know I love you and there for you if you need. So yeah, that's where all of the minds and hearts of Los Angelinos has been this week.
Have you had work stuff that was kind of put off at this point? I mean, is everything kind of shut down? Is there people just regroup and go, wait a minute, we've just dealt with this total catastrophe. We need to figure this out.
Hey, absolutely. I've just had two conversations today with friends. We were trying to promote a couple of projects that I'm doing. And then I had another friend named Chris Bruce, who wonderful guitar player, multi-instrumentalist, played with Seal and Michelle Indigo Cello. Liz Wright, he had a show with his wife, Morley, and they were coming in and he had to cancel that because it just said, it just doesn't feel like the time is right. It feels like all our energies need to be put towards the situation and our friends in need. And it doesn't feel appropriate. It just doesn't feel right. You know, it doesn't feel like promoting your own thing or even trying to galvanize or put together a show, is the right thing to do right now.
I would imagine that at some point music will help. Right. And that people will come together and they'll make music and there will be benefit concerts and there will be people gathering to sort of share in that, because, you know, music is actually a healing force. But like right now, it's like it's a little too soon, maybe.
It's definitely too soon. I mean, there's absolutely nothing has been fully assessed and we're still burning. You know, we have 6 fires burning. And with no sign of containment, you know, that's pretty intense, but you're absolutely right. People are coming together and people trying to do benefits and shows. And, because we have what these things do is they create these scenarios that we're usually become aware of outside of our country. It's usually something you hear about. When you see displacement and the words like refugees come to mind and displacement and decimation and you know, you hear the news media using words like war zone and it looks like a bomb was dropped, and because it does. I mean, entire community our entire communities are wiped out. And like everything you've ever known is gone, like buildings and businesses, churches, synagogues, mosques, it's all gone, you know? So,
right.
Schools, your all, you know, everything you remember growing up.
Yeah. And like, how do you process that? It's like, it's not something anyone conceived of ever. So
no. And so we'll be, you know, most people will be trying to figure out how to, you know, continue sheltering and supporting and raising money for any efforts and needs that people have and will have, continue to have until this subsides, you know.
Yeah. Well, again, I appreciate you talking to me about, I'm going to turn back the clock to some happier times now.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to sort of make clear the context of all this, that we're having this conversation while this has just been going on. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw you, and then we'll go back farther, but I'm going to just put myself into this. First time I saw you, 1999, The Double Door in Chicago, cool club, Richard Thompson's playing there. It was before the album Mock Tutor came out. You weren't actually on the album Mock Tutor. I think that was Dave Maddox, but you came in and played those parts. So you still introduced those parts to me, but like, how did that come about? And then we'll sort of get up to that point.
Thanks for bringing this up. Yeah, it was my first tour with Richard. I was working with some bands out of Dallas, Texas, where I used to live. And I had a friend of mine, a music manager named Donnie Graves, who had just come into working with Richard. And Richard was in need of a drummer because Dave Maddox, after the recording of Mock Tutor, I guess had some gigs and a tour booked with Mary Chapin Carpenter, which opened the door. And Richard needed to find a drummer for the upcoming Mock Tutor tour. And my friend and manager at the time, acting manager, Donnie Graves, called me up and said, "Hey, what are you doing? Would you like, I got something you might be interested in," and introduced me to Richard's, suggested Richard Thompson and introduced me to the music. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, I just said yes, because my buddy was calling me to ask me if I wanted to be a drummer for this guy, Richard Thompson. And of course my answer was yes, because my buddy was asking me. But at the end of the conversation, he said, "You don't know who Richard Thompson is, do you?" And I said, I don't think so. And he goes, "Do yourself a favor." And this tells you when the times were. And he said, "Do yourself a favor and go down to the internet cafe and look him up." So I went a block down the road from my place in Dallas and went to the internet cafe and queued up Rich Thompson. And of course I had to wait on the dial up and the, the noise, and just streams and streams of pages kept going and going and going. I was just scrolling and scrolling. And of course, then I did discover that I had heard Richard, and I didn't realize that those songs and was him, and the guitar playing that I was hearing was him. I was very excited and a little nervous because I had been playing post-industrial metal and punk music at the time and pretty aggressive stuff. And I didn't know how easy the transition of, you know, from playing in a band that was quite loud and dense and high energy with two drummers, me being one of them, to a world that I didn't really know existed, which was the folk world, singer-songwriter world, and in our case, what would be the more folk rock world.
Right.
But a friend of mine came up to me, I ran into on the street, and he said, "How are you doing?" I said, I think I just acquired a gig with a guy named Richard Thompson. And he just froze and stared at me. He obviously knew who it was. And I was talking, and he goes, "I'm a little nervous." He goes, "Why?" I go, "I just never played that music before." And he looked me right in the eyes and he said, "You'll be fine. you've played all these songs before. And, you know, I understood it later on a musician's level, you know, growing up with my mother playing jazz standards and in churches and birthday parties, weddings and country clubs with my mother until I was 17 years old, learning how to play standards and just being a musician and listening to playing with other musicians and playing songs that have a structure. Richard Thompson is not your normal average musician out there. He's kind of a, you know, at the risk of blowing smoke, you know, but I have to blow smoke in the direction of where it's true. He's a cut above the rest in most conversations. Extremely unique and continues to push his own boundaries and create and write. And there's no sign of him like settling down so that you're just making a collection of best ofs, although you could. He's still continuing to do new and innovative things with songwriting and his guitar playing. So it was an incredible opportunity when it did come around, when I finally did meet up with the guys in at JFK Airport, coming back from Germany after visiting some friends, and I met everybody, Danny Thompson, Pete Zorn, and Simon Tassano, tour manager. Our crew was there, Bobby Eichhorn, Paul Gethsemane. Then there was Richard Thompson, Teddy Thompson. It was there. And then there was Richard just standing last waiting for a hug. And then we all got in a car and drove to Amagansett and played Steve at Talk House out there to start after 3 days of rehearsal. And I started my first tour in June of 99 with him.
So was there any actual tryout, or did you just have the gig?
Donnie suggested that I make a compilation CD for him and send it to him. So I did. And years later, I realized that, you know, he gets countless CDs every day, especially when we're on the tour. And he often doesn't listen to them. They tend to stack up over in the corner. And so years later, I asked him, I was like, do you ever listen to these things? And he goes, I try not to, because I don't want to accidentally plagiarize anything. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So, but then my next question was, did you ever listen to the CD I sent you to get this gig? He goes, yeah, I did. And I'm not sure. To this day, he said he did, but to this day, I don't know that he ever really did. I think he just simply trusted Donnie to be his manager at the time. Find him a drummer. That was his job to do. He did. And my job was to show up knowing the material, rehearse, and do the tour. And who knew if it was going to work or not? And after meeting everybody, and it was such a loving, welcoming reception and environment right from the start, you're really kind of nervous that when we go 1, 2, 3, 4 and count it off, is this going to work? And after it all being cool, is this going to work? And I remember looking over at Danny Thompson, he's kind of has his fist in his hand, biting his fingers, like, oh, this could go either way. I hope the kid does all right. You know, I was 27 when I started that gig. And so they were all essentially like my fathers, save Teddy. He was like my brother for right. sure. So it ended up being, you know, from note one, we clicked.
So did they give you an advance of Mock Tutor and say, all right, this is the album we're promoting, and these are the parts we want you to learn and play them like Dave Maddox played them? Or like, how did that work?
Simon Tassano sent me a cassette tape, or Donnie sent me a cassette tape of 28 songs. And since I was visiting friends in Germany for a couple of weeks first, every day that I was over there, I listened to the cassette tape. I would just put it on play, and while my buddy was at work, I would, you know, go around, move around the city or whatever, and go back to the house and just listen to music. And the music I was listening to was the cassette tape they sent me for these songs. So it was a collection of everything from Mock Tutor to Rumor and Sigh and so on and so forth.
Like stuff from the set list coming up, maybe?
Stuff from the set list. Anything that could potentially be on the set list that night. So it was easily two sets worth of of material, and that we could pull from. And that way I could just show up and he could say, let's try this, let's try that. And he was pretty much doing the set the day I arrived. And yeah, from it ended up being, I think the first shift was, obviously joining an already a well-established, well-oiled machine, so to speak, you know, already built in. Maddox has been with him since Fairport, you know, and really kind of helped invent drumming for folk music. You know, he's tried and true, solid, trench style, rock solid drummer that inventive in the way that stays out of the way of all the other polyrhythms that are happening with the music. He kept you solidly on track, and just an incredible mentor and guide for me to, you know, figure out how to do this, you know, and a solid template to build up on while I was trying to figure out and find my own voice and with this music. So yeah, it was a cassette tape of 28 songs.
So were you like playing along with them, or just letting them embed themselves in your head? So when you went to play, you sort of knew them.
You do a little of both, but yeah, you definitely, I had to make those songs as common to me as I had any other band I'd played with prior, to where that when you've actually toured with bands or you were even part of helping to create those songs, they're just in you, you know. I had no real foundation or base of the style, much less the music. So I had to wear it for a while.
Right. Was there anything about it that kind of surprised you when you started playing it? I mean, his stuff is much more kind of rhythmically diverse than certain, when you say folk rock, I think what he does covers a lot more ground than that label would imply.
Yeah, absolutely.
And part of the reason, you know, you stood out to me was just that you were able to do so many things at once, where there's like, you know, keeping the beat, establishing a groove, but also all these textures and rhythms and everything else. Was it a more complex gig than you expected, and was that kind of like up your alley at that point?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, again, you know, learning with my mother, she was a classical pianist and, you know, a music director, choral teacher. And when you're exposed to that sort of conducting and compositional work, like of kind of choirs in a church, you know, you understand the sensibilities of someone who's kind of essentially a composer, you know. And Richard is a compositional writer, you know. He's not just a songwriter. I mean, the music is composed, it's arranged, and you have to be play from a percussion standpoint, you know, knowing the material. It allows you to play dynamically and melodically, and you should adhere to the nuances. What do you think? Forte, piano,
right?
Piano, you know, all the stuff. You know, you can play with dynamics, and I think it was more of an eye-opening experience for me. Comfortable because I'd already done it with my mom, but and more eye-opening to play with. The Western format is kind of a an A, B, A, B, C, A, B structure of music. You know, we go to the verse, the chorus, let's do a bridge, and now we're back to verse, chorus, we're out. And that template is even still the basis of most music we listen to in the West. Richard's music pushes those boundaries for sure. You might live in the bridge for a while. You might live in the solo for a while. It might be a series of verses for a while with the Celtic and Anglo-Celtic bass of origins that his music comes from. You may never hear a blues note in his material. I think it was probably 20, maybe 18 years before I heard him do anything bluesy, but it was because we sat in with the Blind Boys of Alabama.
There you go.
I didn't even know he could do it, but of course he can. Or we started doing Cream and Hendrix covers.
I think, he was my first guest, by the way. But I think I was asking him, I'd have to go back to it. I was asking about, because there's no blues in your playing. He's like, and I think he was like, oh, no, there's blues. I'm like, really? Because I didn't think of him as, I thought of him as like this brilliant guitarist who kind of, I don't know, it drives me a little crazy when people are just talking about the great guitarist like Clapton or whatever. And it's all these bluesy guys. I'm just like I would take Richard Thompson over any of them any day of the week. But not that this is about that. Yeah. But anyway, I what you said about the blues thing is funny because that was my impression as well. But yeah, something like Hard on Me, which is on Mock Tutor. So you're playing that in those shows, fifth song on the album and in your show. And he just goes off, he just goes into like sort of Coltrane land with his solo.
Absolutely. I mean, he came out of the chute playing like that, though, with the first Fairport record. I mean, the band would open up with their, kind of, unison vocal verses, and then off he'd go. And
right.
She would just go have a seat, have a seat. Everybody would just go sit down or contemplate life, and then until the cue came to come back, and I really enjoyed playing with that, being in the heavier rock world. That's what took me by surprise, foolishly, not being unfamiliar with the early days and Richard and Fairport. In hindsight, I look back and why would you ever think that this guy couldn't shred or couldn't just take you for a ride? And not only can he take you on a journey, he can do it without breaking a sweat. I would be soaked back there trying to keep up some nights, and still keep it, make it look like it's on a journey too. I wanted to have a conversation with his playing. And I think that, I can't help but move sometimes with what's being said with the instrument. And whereas most drummers will just stay solid while the soloist goes nuts. Mo Tucker used to say, I was up, I had three egos battling it out at full volume all the time. I had to give them someplace solid to land when they did finally come back down.
Right.
And that's why she just would do, and not move. It's not so much that with Richard, he's taking you on a journey. He's searching. He's moving until the music tells him it's time to move on. Till something tells us it's time to go back. I've said what I needed to say with that. I'll go back to the verse and chorus. But I can't always just stay solid, meaning straight beat while he solos the entire time. I want to be able to help or assist in some way in that journey.
Right.
support it, but also help build the energy and take it where it needs to, you know, respectively needs to be sometimes with, you know, with the energy in that, you know, towards a climax of some sort and then a cool down period of some sort, you know, before we go back in, into, before it resolves back into a chorus or a verse or whatever. But, and that, in that, in, you know, early on, I learned real quick, I get to do that with Richard and I get to do it in my way. You know, he often would only ever say, let's speed that one up or let's slow that one down. Mm. But as far as what I was bringing to the table, I was always allowed to be myself.
Was there a point early on where he kind of looked back and he's like, oh, okay, we're going to keep this guy for a while. You know, this is working pretty well for me.
I think it was after the first song. I think that was it. I think he thought, okay, the only critique I have is just what I said. Yeah, like maybe we'll take that one a little slower, because it definitely was anxious, a bit nervous and much younger then. And I would just, I played everything fast, you know.
Do you remember what the first song was? Was it Cook's Fairy Queen? Because it's the first one on the album, or was it something else?
I think it was Bathsheba.
Okay.
Or it could have been Misunderstood, but for some reason, I think it was Bathsheba.
So same album, just a couple songs in.
Same album. And we definitely, like you said, we did play at least five or six from that, you know, five from that record that year. And we did Semi-Detached after that, the live record.
Right.
So that was actually my first recording with Richard.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Dallas is where you grew up, and yeah. Your mom was very much a part of your musical development.
Right.
Tell me about how you got into music and discovered the drums.
Right.
Please.
That's fairly easy, you know. Music and drumming simply existed. It was always there. It wasn't anything I ever decided to do. There wasn't a conscious decision to do it. I was just doing it. And I think when I was probably 3 or 4 years old, and my mother was a music teacher, like I mentioned, and she had a thing called rhythm sticks, which they used to hand out to kids and teach them how to keep rhythm in the room. And I took those sticks and proceeded to pound on my mother's baby grand piano keys with it, chipping all the ivory. And I remember a scream coming from the kitchen area. Michael, stop! which I totally can still hear, and didn't get it. But to me, at that age, I was just enamored with the sound, which I didn't know at the time. All I needed was a xylophone, but the sound of the sticks making the click sound, and then with a little extra pressure, it would also push the key down, forcing that felt hammer to come down on the string, making the click and the tone of that note, string.
Wow. And how old are you at this point?
I was probably 3.5, 4.
Okay. All right. So we're starting early.
And I thought, wow, that is the coolest sound. I got to get more of that. And so then I started like making a song from it. And that's what destroyed that piano, which I still have today. But then after that, you know, she got me a drum set. I destroyed it Christmas Day. She said, I got to step this up. I got another one from a pawn shop and another, and then finally became enamored with Stuart Copeland.
Wait, how did you destroy that first one?
It was made of paper from Kmart. You know, it was just a kiddie country and Western drum set. And I think I just beat it up on Christmas Day. And then, so she got me a real kit.
There you go.
And said, I need something that's a bit more substantial. And I had that, an orange one and a red one that she would just get at pawn shops or loans from, you know, friends. And would play those until she came home with a Ghost in the Machine from the Police record and said, somebody said the drummer on this is really cool. You should have it, listen to it. And so I took the album straight back to my room and put it on and immediately just loved it. Because before that, you know, Buddy Rich was my first concert, first drummer I ever saw at the Wichita State University Jazz Festival. Him and Ed Shaughnessy. And I was listening to Steve Gadd, you know, daily. Had an 8-track tape of Chick Corea's The Leprechaun that came out in 1976. And I would listen to that over and over again. And, you know, with 8-track, you have to get used to the song with that fade out and then the click over to the next track. And then it would fade back in. And so certain songs, I never heard how the song actually went for probably 30 years till I heard it on CD and thought, oh, where's the fade out? Where's the click in the middle
right.
of that song? You know, but it was all kind of jazz and big band drummers up and soul drummers, you know, from, you know, like the Isley Brothers and stuff like that, James Brown and, you know, those kinds of bands before, you know, and Max Roach, Tony Williams, stuff like that. Before I've discovered rock and that was it. I was like, okay, I'm listening to Def Leppard. I'm listening to AC/DC. I'm listening to the Police. But the Police is what got me. And so
Stuart Copeland.
And then, so I had to buy, you know, if he had a Tama, I had to buy a Tama. So my first professional drum kit was a Tama drum kit, you know, with a Van Halen stripes, you know, red and white stripes wrap around it. It was ridiculous. But
so would you play along with all these records? Like, would you just sort of blast them and then just like get behind the kit and do it?
Sometimes. Other times I would just play them and listen to them. And while they played, I would just listen and study the album covers and try to find more information than was there. But sometimes I'd play along because I hadn't really figured out how to do that yet, play along to where I could actually hear the record and play along at the same time, because I really wanted to listen to it. I just really wanted, at that time, I just really wanted to, I didn't start really doing that until later, like everybody else put on headphones and blasted Neil Peart and tried to play along the Subdivisions, you know, or something like that. And, you know, all fun stuff. And I used to, me and a buddy after school would play along to the Cars' Candy O every day, take turns playing every single song. And like, you'd have the first one, I'd have the second one, and so on and so on, so forth. And that's what we did growing up, you know. And I definitely would learned how to either, improv was always there. It was trying to match exactly what was there.
Right.
What was the exercise as well.
At what point did you think, oh, this is what I want to do with my life, as opposed to this is kind of fun thing to do while I'm doing whatever else?
I think I had two moments of that. One was in the sixth grade where I tried to play cello in the fourth, tried to play trumpet, hit middle C, and I was like, forget this. And I looked over and my buddy was kind of struggling over in the drums, and I couldn't understand why he couldn't just naturally do it. So even at 6 years old, I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to deal with some ego issues in the future. So I mean, let's figure this out. And that didn't take long, because there's plenty of great artists out there that will remind you all the time that you'll never be that. You better figure out how to be yourself and find your own voice and be you, you know, and have some joy in it while you're after it. But the first time was a sixth grade moment, and I decided I'm going to be a drummer again. And I was about 11 years old. I think the second time would have been after high school, after playing football in Texas. You know, you're kind of this mandatory thing that's put on you as a young boy in Texas, is you're playing football. It doesn't matter if you want to play tennis, that's fine, but you're playing football too.
What was your position?
I was tight end, and had a good time. You know, I 3 years of just playing, basically not playing games, but being there, being a crash test dummy for, you know, varsity and junior varsity for 2 years. And then I was also in band those years as well. And so you're the bun of every joke, you know, if you're in band in high school. But I also had all the jock jokes because I was playing football as well. And by the time I was a senior, I played all year. And I think it was kind of a honorary, well, we have to give it to him now. We have to let him play. He's a senior. But I ended up playing, and it was a lot of fun. And I scored touchdowns and, you know, caught passes and had a good time out there, and probably acquired 3 concussions, because back then it was, if you got knocked out, if you answered yes to, are you okay? If you said yes, then you were.
Wow.
That was your checkup back then. You broken arms and all sorts of stuff. And after that, someone reached out, I think from Tarleton State out in Stephenville, West Texas. And they were like, they were giving out scholarships like candy. And I was like, no, my work is done here. I need to go. I couldn't wait to put all my energy and focus back on just being a drummer.
And that was it.
That was it. Those were the two conscious decisions of just, because it never went away. I was always playing, no matter what else I was doing. I never stopped. Like I said, I was in band and marching band and concert ensemble with the orchestra every year.
And you were in a band called the Pop Poppins, or maybe just Pop Poppins. I don't know if there's a guy in there.
It was kind of like the Toadies. We was like, we're not the Toadies, we're Toadies. I was like, okay, whatever.
did you see yourself as like, I'm going to be a band's drummer, and then we're going to like be together for 25 years as this band? Or did you see yourself more as like, you know, I'm going to play with these guys, but I'm going to play with these guys, and I'm going to play with a lot of different people?
No, I only ever wanted to be in one band. I wanted to be like you too. I wanted to be that band that started and accomplished the dream and stayed together. And that's what I wanted. And then, you know, but it didn't really work out like that. So the learning how to diversify and keep yourself busy and playing, that was discovered early on.
Were those experiences in Pop Poppins and Toadies and those other bands, were those good experiences? Or by the time the Richard Thompson thing came up, were you like, you know, I'm ready to join a more established group?
No, they were all fantastic. You know, they were all super fun, the good parts of it, always. Like with Pop Poppins, we didn't struggle on writing songs. There was no struggle on playing together or we had no issues with chemistry. We had issues with other things like communication or, you know, extracurricular activity. You know, you know, there was a time where they, you know, I wanted to just play, and I was, you know, I was a kid who didn't even have drink coffee, tea, or alcohol until he was 30 years old. So anyone doing other stuff at the time and not focusing on just playing music at that time was just like really annoying to me. And I didn't, and I wasn't capable of, I was too young to really understand what was even happening if it distracted from just the music. And Toadies wanted to just rock. I mean, Vaden Lewis just wanted to get up there and rock. But it wasn't a collective. It was, you know, Todd brought the songs and he knew exactly what he wanted and he knew exactly what he wanted you to play and how to play it.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, just sort of how much leeway you had in these different situations to play what you wanted to play or play the song as you felt like it, as opposed to the songwriter saying, this is your part.
Exactly. And Pop Poppins was just as much my baby as it was everybody else's in the band. You know, Bruce, the singer, wrote the songs and Billy wrote the songs and they brought the bulk of the material to it. And then Mark on bass, Billy's brother, the guitar player's brother, and myself would contribute what we would, you know, our parts. And we had total freedom on how we wanted to bring, you know, express ourselves with that. And then sometimes often we contribute to the musical aspects, musical writing of it, instrumental. And Toadies were kind of the exact opposite of that. But I never had to worry about whether or not they wanted to work and play, because they did. They worked hard, and the issue was both bands started taking off at the exact same time, and a choice had to be made. So I was introduced to that early on. And I had mentors in town like Earl Harvin with the Tender Sticks, and he's played with Air and Psychedelic Furs and, you know, MC 900 Foot Jesus and you name it. The list goes on. And a lot of North Texas drummers gave me, I had access to seeing what life was like being a drummer and pursuing a career as a drummer, what that looked like because of them. And dealing with press and the things that people would say about them publicly and how they dealt with that. Matt Chamberlain, Mike Dillon, you know, just to name a few. And so by the time I had to make a tough choice between Pop Poppins and Toadies, I kind of had a little bit of a guidebook. And then later on, even more so when Course of Empire came on the scene, and I was asked to join that band in 93.
At what point were you playing with like Charlie Musselwhite and those, you know, the more blues guys?
So after when Richard Thompson opportunity did come along in 99, I think it was the end of 98, and then the tour started in 99. That's, of course, just opened this door where Danny Thompson probably had a hand in, you know, sharing my ability with other people. And you know, my name just started to get kind of dropped in the hat of that demographic, if you will, and that of or the affiliates of that guard. Because of Danny Thompson, I ended up playing with the Blind Boys of Alabama in 2000.
Right.
And us recording Spirit of the Century with David Lindley and John Hammond Jr., you know, and Charlie Musselwhite. So, and Danny Thompson, of course. And so, and after that Blind Boys opportunity that I'm on with Charlie Musselwhite and everybody and all of the collective artists that were on those things, you're now on that radar. Because you've not only done a record with them, you've played with them, you've spent time with them. They get to know you and they get to, you know, experience playing music with you. And sometimes those connections are lifelong connections, and they have been for me.
Is that a shift for you to go from someone who really has very little blues in his repertoire to, you know, Charlie Musselwhite, who's just Chicago blues?
It really was. I mean, and every time I allowed myself to go there, it could bring on a bit of anxiety. But then I always revert back to my buddy in Deep Ellum when I ran into him and told him I had the Richard Thompson gig. And his response has always kind of helped stabilize me a bit and calm me down, because with the words of saying you've played all these songs before, it now changes the game to about listening. Go familiarize yourself with the genre. Go listen to Robert Johnson. Go listen to Muddy Waters. Go listen to Howlin' Wolf. Go listen to Albert King. Go listen to B.B. King. Go listen to all the Kings.
Right. a lot of good Kings.
Listen to the Three Kings. Yeah. And you get that listen to it and let it marinate with you for a while, and then go do what you do based on the years and experience that you've had playing music and playing your instrument as well, and playing with others. And it becomes, you know, it becomes a really natural thing. But yeah, I remember the bass player with Charlie, Charlie Musselwhite at the time. And he would just kind of, you could tell that I wasn't in the blues world specifically. And he's the one that introduced me to that phrase. He's like, hey, slow down. You know, it's like digging a trench now. It's digging a trench, you know, stay in that trench. And I was like, oh, okay. So he introduced me to that. Yeah, that was it.
Digging for Charlie.
Digging a trench. That was the best. That was the second best advice I ever got in music, you know, as a musician. You know, it's about listening when you're a musician.
What was the best advice?
Well, the best advice was you've played all this music before.
Right.
And, you know, for me, you know, everybody has their what's worked for them best. But the reason why that's better for me, or was the best for me, is because you're really not able to bring your best energy to any situation if there's fear or anxiety, you're super intense. It's good to be a little scared about stuff. I like music and watching things that are just kind of at the edge of their seat. I like being at the edge of my seat a little bit. I like being a little unsure about what's about to happen. It's one of the reasons why I love playing with the Third Mind so much. We don't know what the hell's going to happen exactly. And you're going to get something fresh every time. And so, or we're going to derail and might take out a few trees along the way, but we'll all get there together eventually. Yeah. And sometimes we land, and sometimes it's just the most amazing ride. And it's unique to that experience and that moment, and only that moment. I think it's important to play. I've been really lucky to play with people like Charlie Musselwhite, and John Shalhoub was really instrumental in bringing those people together back in the day with the Blind Boys of Alabama. John Shalhoub's rest in peace. He also took over running and booking McCabe's after Nancy Covey for 20 years.
And then you played with John Cale too. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk.
No. That's it. That's that. And that, this is what made that period so interesting, because I was asked to joined Dustin Boyer and Joe Carnes, Dustin on guitar and Joe on bass, with John Cale for 7 years. You know, we went, that combo had a good run for about 5 years, and then Joe went on to some different projects and has been with Fits in the Tantrum now for at least a decade or so, maybe more. But Dustin Boyer continues to play with John, and I left in 2012. I went from 2005 to 2012. And that was an amazing experience. Again, like most of them, when it was great, it was fantastic. When it wasn't, which sometimes was often just because there were a lot of challenges. You know, we were away from home a lot, and that's tough on a marriage. And it's financially, it could be, you know, it's challenging to be on the road all the time and make sure that you're covering what you need to cover and be exclusive with just one artist.
Right.
You know, so eventually a decision had to be made because I was also touring with Richard Thompson at the time. And I had also started with Better Than Ezra.
Right. Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask you is whether, like, nowadays it's easier to be in multiple bands because they just don't record as often, but you'd still hit those conflicts at some point, I would imagine. But with John Cale, did he expect you to play like Mo Tucker? Did you have those words in your head that I have to just sort of keep out of the way of the other guys, or were you able to still play like you wanted to play?
No, I think he wanted me to be myself. He wanted me to do what I wanted to do. Because he's a, you know, he's a prodigy, you know, he could run circles around most musicians all the time and was more intrigued by what was new to him and different to him outside of the normal expected parameters of pop music, you know, of that pop template I was talking about earlier. And, you know, he's from all of those schools, you know, around with, you know, from John Cage to Tony Conrad to obviously what was curated from those days with the Velvet Underground. I mean, they pushed the boundaries so far. They were, to me, the curators of inventors. They were pre-punk. They were pre-metal. They were pre-noise. They were putting poetry to, well, folk writing, poetry, right, to the oddest of things, like the eclectic music, alternative music. They, all the labels you could put on it, they were, right, doing while they were trying to reach, you know, frontiers that hadn't been even pursued.
Right. And some of it's just gorgeous too. And you're like, oh, that's really pretty on, yeah, top of everything else.
And you're like, where did that come from? And being able to watch John produce and work with ensembles, and he, you know, an artist that would join us on the Paris 1919 gigs or the tributes to Nico that we would do with various artists. We'd have all sorts of artists come in, and sometimes you'd think it wouldn't work, and he'd hear it. He goes, let's, I watched him one time work with, you know, a quartet once, until it got right, until he got what he, you know, what he needed. And he didn't give up on the artist. You know, what I enjoyed is he wouldn't give up on the person. Whereas some people might be like, well, this, you're not going to cut it, and we're not going to be able to make this work with you. I'm going to have to let you go. You know, we're going to have to get somebody else. He would stay with the artist and take their fullest potential and make it work for the behalf of the whole in the song. And, you know, these are the things that really, what I really enjoyed. And I loved playing the Paris 1919 shows, and I loved doing the Nico tributes just because of you were around so many different artists. I know, I'm, you know, sadly, I don't think we ever found our chemistry between us. I thought was great. I thought we had a really good band. We often, it just never felt, at least for me anyway, that we were ever on the same page about anything. But I think in the midst of that, because we were constantly searching, we were able to create, as a band, we created some pretty cool moments. you know, there's still a lot of stuff that we did that is unlistenable to me. And then there's a lot of stuff that we did that I think is like freaking amazing. And I would, I'd reach out and go, man, we really hit it on that one. And he would respond and say, yeah, yeah, we did something there.
Well, and now you're in the third mind with, you know, Dave Alvin and Victor Krummenacher and just a lot of other great musicians, David Immergluck, who I remember playing with Camper Van Beethoven also. And you've made two studio albums with them. And then I think there's a live recording coming up. With either of those albums, had you rehearsed any of the material beforehand, or was that really just a, we're just going to explore this and capture the moment, first take, that's it?
Definitely the latter. You know, Victor had an idea, you know, they had an idea, you know, and, you know, from not just the concept of the third mind, but how we would actually record as well. And it was, just made me think of John Cale and the Dream Syndicate when he was with LaMonta Young, you know, that was a structure of more phrases to repeat and how many times, you know, and just push that, you know. Victor came in with a, okay, guys, I don't really know, none of us know what's going to happen here, but my hope is that we start, we approach this from a dynamic standpoint. I would like to stay relatively calm through this, through the opener, build up, climax here, come back down, and then go back up and then cool down again. Let's do a series of three things. Let's do that three times and let that be our template to get started. And that's what made, literally is what made the first album. It was a collection of songs that he and Dave had decided upon, and Dave brought in Jesse Sykes to sing with him on that. And that approach and those collection of tunes produced the first album.
Yeah, I think it's all covers but one. And you'd played on Victor's records beforehand, so you knew Victor, and you guys are right. The rhythm section. Had you played with Dave Alvin before this?
Dave and I met on that first tour in 99. That tour, probably the tour that you saw.
Right.
That was my first time meeting Dave. And Dave opened up for us on the West Coast leg.
So, yeah, I didn't get Dave.
So you
we know, didn't get him in Chicago.
You didn't get him in Chicago. But so by the time we got to the West Coast, Dave opened up all of the West Coast shows. So every night I would go down and talk with Dave and chat with him while he was setting up to do his sound check. And I'd listen to him during the show. And then I'd go backstage and get ready for our show. And that's how I got to meet and get familiar with Dave. And so my first experience with Dave was acoustic solo, like it is for so many people with Richard. They don't know that they've never seen him with a band or, you know, and the blasters and all of that stuff would come to me later. The Dave Alvin I knew was an acoustic singer songwriter.
Right.
And we always joked and said, you know, we're not joked. We always said, you know, I hope the time comes that we can work together again. I'd love to do some stuff. And, you know, when you click with a lot of musicians, you mean that sincerely, but the times and the opportunity for it to actually happen are kind of few and far between sometimes. So thanks to Victor and Dave, you know, nearly 20, literally 20 years later, they made it possible for that to become a reality.
Did you see that initially as, oh, this will be this nice little experimental side project? And has that perception of it changed as you guys have come back and done more work together?
I think we all thought it was just a little side project. It was just an experiment, you know. I think none of us have ever taken it beyond what we were doing in that moment and in that time, in the present. At the time we were they had the idea. It was just the idea. Then it was, let's get into a room and record this if we can. We pulled that off. Then it was the pandemic, you know.
Right.
And lo and behold, you know, his label picked us up and wanted to put us out and put a tour together. And then they set the date for April 2020. And I was like, oh, missed that one. So, and then, of course, we discovered that he probably during the recording of the first album, he was dealing with cancer. So we, after that, we put it to bed. We didn't think about it anymore. I don't think we were like grateful for the opportunity to have even recorded the record.
Right. You never played a live show at that point because the pandemic just derailed it all.
That's right. We never had an opportunity. We never thought that would even, you know, the idea of being signed and having a tour booked was the last thing we were thinking of. That's like, it was like a, it's like, was it 90? It's like 94 all over again. It's like, who gets signed?
Right.
You know, what is that? So it did surprise. It took us all by surprise. But after, like I said, once we knew that he was going to need to deal with his cancer, and we just put it, I think we all just kind of put it to bed. And, or at least didn't think about it much anymore. We thought about his healing. And, then he came out of it and immediately wanted to work, was working with just about everybody. Rich Holstrom, guitar player, produced that record. And, he wanted to do a second Third Mind record. He was embarking on more work with Jimmy Dale Gilmore. You know, he wanted to do more touring. He wanted to play. And so, and would really get kind of upset at the idea or at the suggestion that he, or if he was sure or not, if he was sure he wanted to do that or not. And it would just kind of piss him off. And so we're like, okay, hear you loud and clear. Let's do this, because nothing would make us happier. And we did. We did Third Mind 2, and it got more attention and more and stirred more energy than the first. And we found ourselves in a position finally at the start of last year, able to do our first tour ever. It actually was the end of, I think, Hardly Strictly in 2023. In the fall was our first gig ever, Hardly Strictly in San Francisco. That was our first show ever. I don't know if it was September or October that year. I don't know. But then 2024 was our first ever touring opportunity. So we did two runs up and down the West Coast. And then we did one run, these are all short runs. The last one in March of 2024 in Texas. And that's as far east as we've been able to come. And that's the best we've been able to do for a grassroots street level band that's trying to become less of an unknown and more of a known, that can stir up enough ticket sales that we can come to your town.
Well, Chicago would definitely support you guys. It's just a matter of getting you all here.
It's getting
once you got here, you'd be fine.
Once we can crack that nut, and I think along with so many other artists out there, cracking the tour budget nut is the challenge, because tour budgets don't exist. And it's all well and good. It's such an honor to have people go, hey, get to our town, for you to even care to say that. Is amazing. And I just want to say, my response is, we'd love to. We're working on it, you know.
Right. Now, there's a reason Richard does all those solo tours, and saw them, you guys, in the trio format. And this last time was the first one you were in sort of the bigger format in years, from what I remember. I mean, it had been a while. But when you're playing these songs in the Third Mind that really are stretching out, like, how does that feel as a musician compared to when you're stretching out with Richard? I mean, is it a similar sort of energy, or is this more like we're really kind of out there even more because you know, we haven't rehearsed this or whatever.
There, that the dynamic with that is the same. You know, Richard, I'm at maximum freedom with the third mind, because, you know, it's we're all out there with just free to our expression. We have our, the cover song is the template, and then there's the way we interpret it. You know, after that, it's any person's guess as to what's going to happen. And we literally are being guided and conducted, so to speak, by the ether, you know. And with Richard, it's the same with, except we are within the constructs of his songs. But when it comes to his solos and expressing ourselves, or when we take solos individually, or when we're supporting his solos, that can sometimes just be that it is the same energy. It is the same feeling, and it's kind of the same approach.
Right. And is that sort of your happy place as a drummer when you're doing that sort of thing? Or are there a lot of different, you know, playing a good pop song is not so bad either.
Sometimes it was a little, it could be intimidating sometimes, because sometimes I just feel like I've always shied away from soloing, and I don't know how to describe it. It's, you feel a little, some artists have no problems with just showing you all they got at all times. Appropriate or not, it doesn't matter. It's about, these are my chops, and you're going to get a face full of them. I am more appreciative of the drummers who play for the song. Although sometimes when I listen back to some of the recordings I've done or live performances, I'm like, man, what were you drinking that night? You're just all over the place. And I realize that sometimes you're just moved. I'm just moved by the conversation that's happening in the moment, and I can't help it sometimes. So it's really a wonderful exercise for me to make sure that all the pieces are able to be heard at the right time.
Right.
To help that song actually be received. Because if I'm dancing all over the place because I'm having a good time, there's a time and place for that. And then there's other times where it's like, okay, let's look and see where we might want that. We might need to take a different approach so that everybody, not just you, is getting off on this song.
There you go. I think the writer equivalent of that is like your writer, to include myself, who doesn't really like writing in first person. And like you're drumming to support the song, but you're not drumming to say I.
Right, that's it. And it's, I'm look, we love the musicians we love because of the material that they've been a part of, and that they were either written or been a part of. You know, a lot of musicians, and they are probably some of your favorite musicians, not because they put out a solo record of just them playing in a room. It was because of the project they were with. It was because of who you saw them with. You saw them on stage. You heard them in a recording. And that song and their ability to play, to be a part of that composition, to be just one part of that machinery that made this whole beautiful tapestry, you know, is why you think of a, like, oh yeah, that's what, he's one of my favorite artists. Why? Because of what he did by himself? No, it's because of what he did with that group or that collection of artists or that project or that song. You know, it brought you, it highlighted that musician, that musician's work was highlighted because of what they were a part of. And I'm always, most artists are looking, I'm looking for collaborative experiences like that. So I can, you know, not only just find my own voice, but you know, have my best conversations, you know, find my best potential and help everybody else I'm playing with find theirs too, you know. And then everybody has a great time. Everybody's inspired on stage, and hopefully the audience gets, they're a part of it too, you know. And you can see it, you can see when it's clicking, so to speak, because when there's just people who just cannot sit down and they have to dance and they're moved and they got to stand up and they respond through the song, during the song and after the song and after the show, the comments come, you know. So that's what we're all working toward, you know. And that just happens to be my own approach towards trying to achieve that.
Well, that's great. It's, I've always responded to it whenever I've heard you play. So, you know, and the Third Mind stuff is really cool. And, you know, it's harking back to this kind of 60s psychedelic thing, which I like. Yeah, I've totally enjoyed those Third Mind records, and it's cool to hear you on that. And it's great to talk to you about this, and I really appreciate it. My only last question is just, how many bands are you actually in right now? Are you still in Better Than Ezra also? Because you guys still put out an album this past year.
Absolutely. They put out a record called Super Magic last year. And we put, you know, we put that out and toured it a little bit, and still doing shows with it. And that's been a lot of fun. Richard Thompson, like you mentioned, it had been 5 years since we toured together, and been
you
making
guys,
records.
You guys made Ship to Shore.
And we did Ship to Shore. And then with Slash, he had a project called Slash's Blues Ball.
Right.
And
I had that on my list too.
Well, we made a record in 2023 called Orgy of the Damned. And the artwork just reminded me of like Good Times, like the same artist. Remember that TV show Good Times? I was sure. Like, man, this is really cool. And we did the Serpent Festival tour that Slash put together and brought a bunch of wonderful guests out, like Warren Haynes and ZZ Ward and Eric Gales and Keb Moe and so on and so on. I have my own projects. You know, of course, we've talked about the Third Mind, but, you know, a real love of and heart felt project that has kind of keeps all the wheels going. And it's my project of inspiration, you know, when everything else just kind of starts to make me feel a little tired, I just fall on the hulls of the machine. And it's basically myself and the guitar player from Course of Empire from the 90s, from Deep Ellum back in the day. And we just went 180 degrees from all our dense, heavy stuff that we used to do with Chorus. And at the end of every Chorus record, there was always this peaceful, like calming period, a melody that Mike would write, and they would end their records with that. And we decided to just, well, what would it sound like if we just made a whole album like that? And at that time, when industrial, when everybody was just trying to out heavy one another, and Ministry's doing it, and grunge is around, and everybody's just trying to just blow your head off, we thought, hey, well, let's go this way now. But if you did that at that time, you know, you were conscious of trying to slipping into the Inya territory or the, you know, Yanni. You didn't want to go that route. So, and whereas now, the older you get, you know, it's like, you know, actually, it's exactly where I, you know, maybe not specifically those two artists, but, you know, for us going with Mike is one of another extremely innovative and melodic guitar players that I've been lucky enough to work with. And his melodies and stylistically, we're on the same page, and it's just been a great outlet. So we're releasing our first album that we did 25 years ago with a keyboard player and producer named Eric Van Martin. And we're going to keep on going.
So you did the album 25 years ago?
We made that first record 25 years ago. In fact, we finished it before I went on tour with Richard.
Oh, wow.
And I would listen to it every night on the bus, just to you know, because it was always kind of this, like, we're tweaking it and how do we get into the soundtrack movie market and trying to do that. So I was listening to mixes and trying to see if what else we needed to do. But it was basically done. And I was using it as a kind of a calling card to say, hey, we do soundtracks if you're interested. Kind
nice.
Of
thing. You guys going to tour behind that too, or just get it out?
You know, life went on. Life carries on. And he got married and had a child and had a beautiful son and is a franchise owner, partner in a franchise is called Nothing Bundt Cakes in Little Rock, Arkansas. And they're about to open up their third location in Hot Springs. So, you know, and I moved out here.
Wow.
And Van Eric stayed in Fort Worth. And so, and runs an extremely difficult business where he takes care of homeless and drug addicts and sorting out people who are trying to get their lives back on track. And is a full-time job counseling and helping people sort their bail bonds and get their lives back in order and to find a place to either choose to be on society, a part of society again or not.
So you need one album release reunion show.
Incidentally, that yes. And that's what we're working on, hopefully in March and in March and in April, we're going to have a couple of opportunities where we're just going to bring down the guy who actually helped get all of these bands, early bands we were mentioning earlier, get us all back on track. His name is Alan Restrepo, and he runs a company called Carpe Diem Works. He's going to bring down the new reissue of Pop Poppin's collection. He's going to bring down Course of Empire's first album before they were signed with Zoo Records on BMG. And he'll bring down, he might have other projects, and we'll bring down our re-release of Atmospheres for Lovers and Sleepers with Halls of the Machine for sure.
Nice.
Yeah. That'll be at the Kessler in Dallas in April 18, I believe. So.
Wow. That sounds great. Well,
yeah.
Thank you so much. I can't wait to see and hear you again. Good luck with all that's going on out there. It's a rough time, obviously, and I'm sure, a lot of people appreciate your efforts and checking in and doing what you can.
Man, thanks so much. I've enjoyed it, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about all this stuff.
That's all for episode 164 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Michael Jerome for offering so much insight into his playing and those with whom he has made music. We especially appreciate his talking with us at such a fraught time in Los Angeles, and we're thankful for his perspective on what life there feels like right now. For more information about him, his various projects and tour schedule, go to MichaelJeromeOnDrums.com. The Third Mind has one upcoming live date on the books right now, March 21st at Coach House Concert Hall in San Juan Capistrano, California. Time to start booking those flights. And look for the Halls of the Machine album to come out sometime this spring. Michael Jerome has a Facebook page and is on Instagram at MMJerome. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who drives this thing from ship to shore. If you'd like to support Carol Pop, we'd be much appreciative. You can throw something in the tip jar. Please go to carolpop.com and you can give whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter X at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.